The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We have a very, very special guest joining us this morning, Nicholas Vardy, live from London. Nicholas is a good old Pittsburgh boy and a graduate of Stanford University. He's also a widely recognized expert on ETFs, and he is an accomplished investment professional. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you for having me.
No, thanks for joining us from across the pond.
Well, Nicholas, and of course, you're kind of our go-to guy when we have to talk about anything Brexit, and also your boots on the ground for pretty much comments on the global economy. And with Theresa May, she's going to the House of Commons, I guess, today. She's got 5 working days before that big vote on January 15th. Just about what is the feeling, I guess you could say, in that part of the world about this Brexit deal and what might become of it?
Well, I think there's one word that would sum up the current state of the of British politics and the mood in London and the rest of the UK, and that is chaos. Right now, Theresa May negotiated a deal with the European Union back in November and is in the process of presenting it to the UK Parliament. She needs about 320 votes to get that plan approved. Right now, she probably has about 240. And so there's really no one in the UK Parliament who expects this deal to pass. It is opposed both by the Remainers as well as the Brexiteers for various reasons. And because of the incredible complexity of the breakdown of the UK Parliament and representations by MPs, members of Parliament from Scotland and from Northern Ireland, and other factions that don't vote and speakers' roles, etc., it's highly, highly unlikely that Theresa May's plan is going to be approved. And that raises the very real possibility of a no-deal Brexit, which is when things may spiral down into an incredibly chaotic solution at 11 p.m. on March 29th when Brexit actually happens.
Interesting. And how long will it take Britain to leave the EU?
It will literally happen at 11 p.m. on March 29th. And the issue is on what terms they leave. Because broadly speaking, the terms of their leaving happen with two kind of framework models of agreement. One is the withdrawal agreement. Consider it like a divorce agreement. How much is Britain going to, the UK going to pay to the EU for leaving, and the terms of that agreement. And the second part of it, which is the more complex one, is a new trade agreement with the EU. Because, of course, the European Union, a substantial part of being part of the European Union is having essentially a customs agreement with mainland Europe, and assuming a no-deal Brexit, literally all legal relationships between the EU and the United Kingdom come to a screeching halt, and everything devolves to a World Trade Organization tariff and customs backdrop. And that is going to cause a lot of problems for this country.
Do you think there could be a second referendum on this? Because I know, I guess last night, Theresa May was handed a bit of a setback. I guess some of the lawmakers restricted the tax varying powers. If they happen to get out without any kind of an agreement.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's basically three things that can happen between now and the 10 weeks till we have till March 29th. Number one, the Theresa May's Brexit plan is approved by Parliament, which I suggested is highly unlikely. Number two, that there's a no-deal Brexit, which is going to lead to a very chaotic situation. And number three, that there's a new referendum. The challenge is that time is running out, and in fact, there are certain provisions in UK law right now that say referendums have to be launched 15 to 20 weeks before an actual event happens. And as a result, it's almost too late to have a second referendum by that first deadline. So the obvious question arises, well, could that deadline not be extended. In other words, could the European Union not just kick the can down the road, as they want to do in many other similar instances? And the answer to that is yes, they could, but it would require the accession or the agreement of all 27 other EU nations. And even organizing such a meeting where all 27 EU nations would agree to extend the Brexit deadline is something that is difficult, if not impossible. An interesting a fourth possibility, which is, you know, we'll see if that actually happens. I mean, no one's really talking about it yet, that there was a European Court of Justice ruling, I believe in late November, which said, which asked the question or answered the question whether the UK could unilaterally rescind the Article 50, the basis on which Brexit was first initiated. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that question is yes. And so, ad absurdum, the UK could come out tomorrow and say, okay, Brexit is all called off, and that would be perfectly legal. Of course, that would have all sorts of internal political implications for the 51% of the people in the UK who voted for Brexit, and it would be political suicide for many members of Parliament. But I think the European Court of Justice did give the UK that out back in November, I believe, where they could abandon the whole thing. And that, of course, would, you know, in the grand scheme of things, or at least certainly in the short term, make life a lot more easier for everybody. So it's a very complicated process, And, you know, all the political jockeying you read about Theresa May doing this or that or the other thing. I mean, look, this gulf between her support in the parliament and getting the deal approved is so wide. I mean, it's literally like 100 votes. You know, to turn that into a passage of her program called the Chequers Plan is really, I mean, I think there's very few people who think that that's going to be possible. Now, what's happening is that there's a bit of panic ensuing among the members of parliament. And for the first time in many years, members of opposition parties, the Conservatives, Labour and some other smaller parties, the Lib Dems, are actually getting together behind the scenes, meeting in the committee rooms in Westminster, the House of Parliament, and trying to avoid some kind of a no deal Brexit scenario, because that would cause a lot of problems. I mean, the government is already stockpiling medicines; it's literally stockpiling food for when the trade breaks down on March 30th. To give you an idea of the impact of this, every year there's about 4.2 million lorries or trucks that come over from the that go between the European Union and Britain. And even if WTO rules come in, each of those trucks are stopped for 10 minutes. It's just going to cause an incredible backdrop or a backlog of trucks. So, you know, in Dover, which is where a lot of these trucks come in, go back and forth between the UK and Europe, they're actually now bringing in old airfields where they're going to be parking some of these trucks that have to go through all sorts of customs inspections that they're going to have to go through after March 29th just to deal with what's going on. So it's in practice, it's becoming very, very difficult. And that's just sort of one area of the problem, but that's sort of a concrete example.
Interesting. Well, we're bumping up against the break, folks, but stick with us. You could basically have a PhD in Brexit by the time we're done with Nicholas today. He really understands this to an extent that I haven't had the chance to talk with anybody at this level. So you're listening to Straight Talk Money with Chase Robertson, Peggy Tuck, Nicholas Vardy, the opening bells on the other side of these important announcements.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions. We have a very special guest. We've got Nicholas Vardy with us today, and we're actually speaking with him from London. He's an ETF specialist with the Oxford Club. Really, really smart guy. We've used him for years, especially when it comes to getting a pulse on not only what goes on in the UK, but also on a global level. But we're talking about the big vote that's going to be coming up on Brexit on the 15th.
Well, before we ask about how to invest around this, mm-hmm. I have a question for you, Nicholas. How is this going to impact labor? You know, qualified labor seems to be a big issue here in the U.S. I know there's a lot of labor that comes from surrounding countries. for Britain. How does this have? What's the net impact of this event?
Look, it's going to be tough. I mean, I think just living in London, for as long as I have. I have to say that in the service industry, so anything from, going to a restaurant or, if you're moving apartments or flats or, getting your whatever washing machine repaired, it's very rare to run into Brits who actually do that kind of work in London. It's either the Poles or the Bulgarians, a lot of East Europeans or Romanians. And so a lot of the restaurants and the hotels in London, that whole industry has been lobbying against Brexit because literally if these young people aren't able to come to the UK and spend a year or two there, doing what they do, or like the Poles, about 600,000 of them actually moving to the UK and being there for about 20 years starting businesses, it's feeling that they need to leave or they're unable to stay, it's going to have a massive impact on just the the other area where it's going to have is already having massive impact is in the NHS, the National Health Service, because a lot of the nurses there are also foreign. A lot of the doctors are also from EU countries and are foreign. And because of the uncertainty, a lot of these doctors and nurses have already started to leave because their status is uncertain. And, just think about it. I mean, if you're there, a young professional, you've got a young family and you've got kids going to school and you don't know whether you're going to be able to stay in the country or not. A lot of people are kind of metaphorically throwing up their hands and saying, okay, well, screw it. I'm out of here. I'm going back to Poland. I'm going back to, Germany. I'm going back to Spain. I'm going back to Italy because, we need stability for our family. And again, the number of, there are 1 million EU citizens out of a population of 8 million in London itself. And a lot of those people are working in these kind of, service jobs or even, more highly qualified jobs in the National Health Service. And so there's just simply not enough qualified UK nurses and qualified UK doctors to sort of, fill in the gaps, let alone people, serving you from behind the bar. That's going to take that kind of labor shortage situation that you have in the US and elsewhere in mainland Europe, or really globally in many respects and make it that much worse. The challenge is that unlike when Ireland voted to join the EU or Norway voted not to join the EU, once you're already in this relationship and, Britain was the United Kingdom was one of the core members of the, what turned out to be the, European Community and the European Union, you're so intertwined with the rest of Europe. It is like a divorce, taken to an extreme degree. So Jeff Bezos is going to have a real tough time divorcing his wife because he's a wealthy guy. Well, take that to the upteenth degree when the country tries to do that. And so there's a lot of unintended consequences there, and it makes it very, very complex for a lot of people. And look, the UK has about 60 million people, almost 4 million of them are these EU citizens who have been living there for a long time, and a lot of people have made their lives there in the last 20, 25 years since they've been able to live there on EU passports, and they haven't bothered getting UK passports, and people who've been living there for 20 years are basically picking up and leaving because they just don't know what's going to happen. So it's a challenge.
Yeah, not to mention you're unwinding what almost 50 years of treaties and.
I mean it's really complex. I mean, technically, for example, after March 29th, the UK is not going to be part of the European airspace anymore. So as of right now, there's no. Planes from Europe should not be landing in the UK after March 29th. Okay, all air traffic should stop. Now, in anticipation of a no-deal Brexit, the Brits sat down with their European counterparts and actually sort of changed the law over Christmas where to say, okay, well, not all flights are going to stop. We're going to continue doing it. But, for example, there's going to be no, airlines completely lose their flexibility. So if there's 10 direct flights from, Stockholm to London every day, you can't make it 8, you can't make it 12, you have to keep it at 10. Just because there's no legal structure there for it. Now, take that and, multiply it by everything from, so for example, in the EU, if you're a doctor from Germany, you can come to the UK and your diploma from Germany works in the UK because it's accepted because of the EU. It's like going from, the analogy is like, let's say you graduate from University of Chicago Medical School, you move down to Houston and no one's going to question whether, just because you got your medical degree at University of Chicago in Illinois, Texas is still going to accept it. Well, what if Texas does a Texit you know, and says, okay, well, we're not going to recognize any degrees outside of Texas. Well, that would cause a lot of problems, I think, in Texas hospitals, too, in spite of the fact they've got some excellent medical schools down there. Mm-hmm. And just sort of take that and see the impact that it has on people's lives and you know, professional qualifications and mobility and, you know, everything. And it's tough to undo these things. So,
but the UK, challenge. Through all this, at least they have their own currency. And whereas a lot of the other countries dropped their currency and went to the euro. So, and also it's a major financial hub. And we've seen some companies that have already said, some of these very large banks that have said that they're going to be moving or have moved their headquarters from there. What kind of an impact could that have on the global economy?
Well, I think I don't know what kind of impact it would have on the global economy. I mean, look, a lot of these financial institutions, you know, have tens of thousands of people work in the UK. And what they do is they take the relatively lower level jobs, you know, the back office jobs, which are crucial in terms of, you know, settling trades and compliance and everything like that. And what they've started to do over the past couple of years is move those jobs to other alternative financial centers, to Dublin, to EU financial centers. You know, Ireland is obviously a different country there, so they're kind of nearby. So they move them to Dublin, they move them to Frankfurt. A lot of staff are moving to Paris, and let's say have a workforce of 40,000-50,000. You know, they've been, you know, moving 7,000-8,000. We call it 10-15% of their workforce over there. Now, what that also has is that has a kind of a knock on effect in all sorts of ways in living in London, because suddenly there's less high income people willing to rent apartments and houses in London, and so that's put a pressure on rents, which in turn puts a pressure on real estate prices. So in terms of, you know, the kind of the knock-on effects of, you know, these financial institutions and their high-income people sort of moving out, it does have a knock-on effect. So, for example, in my neighborhood in London, and this is interesting because it's literally not reported anywhere in the press because the real estate agents have an incentive not to report it, asking prices for high-end properties have dropped 20%, which is a big drop. And add the 15% depreciation of the pound, basically, London property is now one-third cheaper than it was 2 years ago.
Oh.
In many ways, that's an opportunity. It's something you'll never hear about because people don't have an incentive to say it, but it does have serious knock-on effects, and that's just one of them.
Yeah, I mean, in certain neighborhoods, that's a big haircut on a monetary basis. It's a big, big haircut. Anyway, folks, you're listening to Straight Talk Money with Chase Robertson, Peggy Tuck, Nicholas Vardy.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
All right, folks, welcome back to Straight Talk Money. I'm your host, Chase Robertson, Peggy Tuck. If you're just joining us, we have had a lot of fun interviewing and speaking with Nicholas Vardy. He was a good old Pittsburgh boy, also a graduate of Stanford University, by where I used to live. But I'm going to go ahead and ask the question that everyone's been waiting for. Nicholas, if you were an investor, how would you play this event in the liquid space?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, these type of, you know, intense crisis situations always offer terrific opportunities. So the more scared people get of an opportunity, the bigger the opportunity in the end, because I find that in the end, things are never as bad as they seem, you know, initially. So as difficult as I sort of posited this and described the current situation, that's in the midst of sort of the to and fro of the daily political drama going on in Westminster, the UK House of Parliament. But a couple of opportunities specifically that I can recommend. You know, last year, the UK, perhaps not unsurprisingly, was probably the worst performing developed global market in the world. I mean, of course, very few assets did well last year, but even within that, the UK did particularly poorly. At the same time, and that's, you know, between now and March 29th, that's probably, you know, unlikely to do particularly well because people are avoiding risk. They're taking on currency risk because of what might happen to the pound and you know, the value of your dollars that you invest will go down as the pound goes down. But I think because of that, you know, even after Brexit, no matter what happens, the UK is the sixth or seventh biggest global economy in the world. It's very inexpensive. It's interesting that the mid and small cap sector here has been particularly strong for many, many years, for well over 50 years. So, for example, you guys as investment advisors know that, you know, there's this thing called the small cap effect, which is like basically small caps tend to outperform large cap stocks by about 1 or 2% a year, you know, over time. And you compound that over time, makes a big difference. Well, in the UK, that small cap effect is actually like 6 or 7%. So it's a huge difference, huge outperformance in the UK small cap sector. And there's no real direct way to get that as a U.S. investor, but there's a UK ETF for the large cap stuff, and the ticker symbol for that is EWB, I believe, and that gives you exposure, I believe, to the MSCI, you know, UK index, and you can get that, you can buy that in your normal U.S. brokerage account, and so that might be an opportunity, you know, dare I say, on March 30th or March 28th or whatever, you know, right around that, you know, Brexit type period. Because it's likely to be, again, it's very news driven, so it's hard to say, you know, when the ideal, you know, time is to buy it. But you know, it is a dynamic, you know, economy, a lot of opportunities in terms of you know, valuations compared to the U.S. market. Mm-hmm. So I think looking at a UK ETF, would be something that you might want to take a look at, you know, as a U.S. investor, if you want to trade around, you know, these kind of events like Brexit.
Those micro cap or small cap companies, they're listed on the AIM?
AIM is, they're not, they don't even have to be listed on AIM. You know, the AIM is the alternative investment market, and it's kind of, to use a Britishism or UKism, they're a little bit dodgy. There's not much disclosure that has to be done to get listed on there. It's a little bit like a slightly more refined version of like the US OTC market kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know? And so, you know, when things are rocking, you know, those things tend to do very, very well, and they move out, you know, they almost trade like options or something. And there's a lot of like mining companies, and kind of venture capital trust, which is kind of a UK structure that are traded on there, you know, kind of smaller companies. But even some of the stocks that trade on the London Stock Exchange, and the English companies on Euronext, you know, offer some opportunities there as well. So AIM is a particularly, that's like a micro cap kind of, you know, OTC style market. So you'd really have to know what you're doing to sort of start investing in those. But if your audience is interested in getting a sense of what the UK market looks like, there's a, you can go to a website called moneyweek.com. And that's the website of the UK's largest financial weekly that's published there. It's actually published by an affiliate of the publishing company that I'm affiliated with, Agora Publishing, and it'll give you a good idea of what that kind of UK market looks like and get a flavor of what that looks like. And what's interesting about it is it's in English, so it'll be very familiar. At the same time, it's very different from the US market, but you can access that whole kind of world there. So you might want to take a look at that for specific opportunities in the UK.
UK's best-selling financial magazine. Yeah, folks, if you can't remember that, which there are definitely some mornings pre-coffee, I can't remember anything. StraightTalkMoney.com, Peggy can get that link over to you, no problem. But anyway, no, you know, I'll sit down with Charles Sizemore this afternoon, and maybe we'll come up with some ETFs that we'll talk about and tomorrow, the next day, of ways to play this. This is interesting and maybe a fun exercise to crank up. To crank up the brain and see how we could play this.
Nicholas, real quickly before we've got about 3 more minutes left of the show, but you mentioned that the UK, that their return basically economically was not that good. Lately we've seen, I just want to touch globally real quickly, we're seeing a softening in China a little bit. They've been reporting that. And then just this week I saw some numbers coming out of Germany with a little softening there. Mm-hmm. What do you see globally looking in your crystal ball?
Well, look, I mean, I think according to the IMF projections, they've reduced their projections for global growth. I think, I'm not 100% sure, but down to about 4.6% or something. So it's still pretty reasonable. Of course, you know, when you look at quote unquote emerging markets or global markets, so much of a big chunk of that is going to be China. So if you look at a broader emerging markets exchange traded fund like VWO or EEM, you know, a big chunk of that's going to be China. And China, of course, is going to, you know, either take that up or take that down. I mean, there is a lot of slowdown going on in China. So I think in terms of you know, specific opportunities, you know, I think you're going to have to be more of a rifleman as opposed to sort of a shotgun, you know, person in terms of looking at global markets. So I think, you know, China is the big kahuna. Of course, Germany is, you know, still the third biggest exporter in the world. So it's a big, you know, it's a big economy. It's about 60% of the economy of the European Union, which is, you know, actually together, it's a bigger economy than the U.S. So it's a big, you know, it's a big, big economy as well. I think, you know, China's the big issue. And I think I've never been a big fan of China because I think there's a lot of things that go on there that are, not very kosher. They're very much indebted. There's, you know, they remind me of what kind of, it's a little bit like what, you know, even Paul Samuelson, you know, the guy who wrote the econ textbook that a lot of people studied out of, said that the Soviet Union was going to take over the U.S. You know, and he was saying that in the 1987 edition, and 2 years later, the Soviet Union collapsed. And I don't want to say that China's going to collapse, but I think it's probably the economy's a lot weaker than that thinks. And when it happens, it's probably going to happen, you know, pretty quickly. So that's something you got to be careful of. China, I'd probably stay away from, though there are interesting short ETFs to take advantage of that. Otherwise, I think the global economy is probably going to do okay, albeit at a slightly slower pace in 2019 than 2018.
Yeah, we absolutely agree. That's, you know, double digit returns out, but, you know, with a good dividend strategy, we think, you know, a high single digit return is achievable this year, which, you know, at 7%, you're on pace to retire. So, anyway, Nicholas, thank you so much for joining
us from
London.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure to have you and to offer your insight to our listeners.
Good luck. Good luck.
Anyway, folks, hope you have a great day. Dow just popped up to 166. Looks like we're headed to 200, which is exciting. Fourth, fifth day, I think, in a row for energy and stocks to be moving. You were listening to Straight Talk Money. Chase Robertson, Peggy Tech. We'll be back tomorrow at the regular time. And as Mike Robertson would say, God bless.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.